ॐ त्र्यम्बकं यजामहे सुगन्धिं पुष्टिवर्धनं उर्वारुकमिव बन्धनान् मृत्योर्मुक्ष्यममृतात्। 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 ॐ त्र्यम्बकं यजामहे सुगन्धिं पुष्टिवर्धनं उर्वारुकमिव बन्धनान् मृत्योर्मुक्ष्यममृतात्।
Good afternoon, and good evening, and good morning, and welcome to our fifth class, our fifth Sangam on the path of life and death. This week and next week, we're going to work kind of intensively with a couple of what I found to be two really, really powerful methods for working with our own suffering, both our day-to-day suffering and our intense suffering, the suffering of illness, of deep loss, and ultimately of dying. Last week, we discussed the terrain of the astral worlds. Next week, we're going to go in detail through the process of moving through the bardos, the after-death bardos. It'll be a little bit of a navigation class in part. And this Sunday, I want to let you know we're going to have a long Q&A, which you can tune into at 5 p.m. Pacific time on this channel. And we'll also be having some Q&A in this class tonight. So find yourself a posture. And if you're walking or driving, understand that the closed-eyed parts of these practices are probably not the best thing to do at this time, but a lot of them can be done open-eyed. So for all of us here live and for all of us listening later tonight or tomorrow or the next day, let's start with our aspiration prayer. Take a deep breath in, a big inhalation, expanding the belly, and then a long exhalation. And remember, as you exhale, draw the belly in towards the spinal column, which helps expel the old air. And with the inhalation, feel that you're receiving the energy of all those lineage beings, all those helpful presences, all the love that floats around this class and each one of you as we come together. So once again, inhaling, and then with the exhalation, just simply let go of whatever you're carrying, whether it's tension or nervousness or the various forms of distraction or any uncomfortable feelings. And inhale again with the sense that you're drawing in grace. And because today we're going to be practicing with the heart, just see if you can draw in grace through the heart. And finally, with the exhalation, just letting go. Now feel the presence of the Sangham. And a lot of you have had the experience of how very palpable and real it feels when you just open your awareness and become aware of all of us being here present with you, with me, with each of us. Recognizing that this presence is here, whether we're here live or whether we're listening later, or whether we're listening 2 months from now, we're on a subtle level all together. So with this feeling of the presence of each of us, of the expanded satsang that stretches across the globe, imagine yourself lighting your candle and place it in the center of the circle. And you also might imagine a flower in your hand and place that too in the center of the circle. And then together we'll make this aspiration prayer. Inhaling, have the thought, may what we are about to do give beneficial results. Exhaling, may it give us the power to be of real benefit to others. Inhaling, may it help us overcome our negativities and delusions. Exhaling, may what we are about to do clear away obstacles on our path. Inhaling, may it propel us to a future state of enlightenment. And recognize that by articulating this aspiration, we actually draw in our connection to that future state. Whatever our experience of that future state may be, whatever our aspiration may be, whether for oneness, for a feeling of liberation from the various forms of suffering, whether it's an experience of deep connection to others, or the experience of utter, absolute, light-filled blissfulness, these states are what we're drawing into our field. And with all that in mind, we offer our conversation this evening for the benefit of all sentient beings. And once again, finding your posture, we'll chant first the Mahamrityunjaya mantras and then Om Namah Shivaya Gurave.
Om Trayambakam Yajamahe Sugandhim Pushti Vardhanam Purvarukam Vabandhanan Mrityor Mukshiyamam Ritat Om Trayambakam Yajamahe Sugandhim Pushti Vardhanam Purvarukam Vabandhanan Mrityor Mukshiyamam Ritat Om Trayambakam Yajamahe Sugandhim Pushti Vardhanam Purvarukam Vabandhanan मृत्योर्मुक्ष्यामृतात् ॐ त्र्यम्बकं यजामहे सुगन्धिं पुष्टिवर्धनं उर्वारुकमिव बन्धनान् मृत्योर्मुक्ष्यामृतात् ॐ त्र्यम्बकं यजामहे सुगन्धिं पुष्टिवर्धनं उर्वारुकमिव बन्धनान् मृत्योर्मुक्ष्यामृतात्
Become very conscious of the feeling of your sits bones, your buttocks against the seat. Become aware of the way that your spinal column actually rises up from the very center of your pelvis. And see if you can find that triangle, that physical triangle, which is made by the pubic bone in front and by the two sits bones behind. See if you can position yourself as though your spinal column were arising from the center of that triangle. Inhaling, let the base of the body become heavy. Exhaling, feeling the breath helping lift the spinal column upward through the crown. Very, very gently allow the shoulder blades to melt onto the back so that the chest lifts and opens. And bring your right hand over the area in your upper chest, perhaps with the base of the hand more or less touching the U-shaped notch at the sternum. But most of your palm over the region in the upper chest where we generally find the heart center. It's a little bit to the right of the physical heart. And as you inhale, sense the inhaled breath coming into and creating space in the inner heart. Your awareness flowing towards the back of the heart. And then with the exhalation, see if you can sense the breath moving through the inner chest area, opening up your awareness of what we sometimes call the cave of the heart. This inner region where it's said that the individual soul has its seat, and which is for most of us the most inward place we know. The place where we bring our contemplation, where we bring our self-exploration Imagine that the heart cave is literally a cave made out of gentle, luminous light. And that light, for some of you, may be dark light. It may be that velvety darkness that we associate with the causal body. So as you begin to become more present to the depths of your own heart cave, don't expect it to look a certain way or to feel a certain way. But have the intention with each inhalation to allow your consciousness to penetrate deeper into the region in the back of the heart. And with the exhalation, to allow yourself to feel more and more settled, more and more nestled into the heart cave. And you can begin to offer the mantra almost as though it were a flower, to offer the mantra into your own heart. Inhaling Namah Shivaya, exhaling with the feeling that the fragrance, the emanation of the mantra, gently opens and deepens your connection to the heart. Gently open your eyes. Or I'm very happy if you continue breathing into the heart cave and letting every exhalation draw your sense of the presence of that inner cave more and more wide. Part of why I decided to give this course, and I believe part of the reason that you're taking it, is to really help us begin to have a sense of how important the awareness of death is for a person who wants to live a powerful and intentional life. In the warriors' cultures, you know, in Kamakura Zen, which I used to love to read about, that's the samurai Zen practice that it was prevalent in Japan at a certain period in history. And in other warrior cultures, including our current military culture, there's a very strong recognition that death is something that can happen any minute. It's an ever-present possibility. And if you are using death as a part of your spiritual practice, if you're using the possibility of dying as a way to keep yourself present to the fact that this could be your last moment, and therefore it's a moment to approach with maximum commitment, presence, excellence, you know, very much as Mary Oliver writes, you know, in her beautiful poem, When Death Comes, when she says, when it's over, I don't want to wonder if I've made of my life something particular and real. I don't want to find myself sighing and frightened or full of argument. I don't want to end up simply having visited this world. So the awareness of death, as she very beautifully says in this poem, is one of the ways that we cure our tendency to kind of move through life distractedly or to believe that our real life is going to start as soon as we find the right job or meet the person that we are going to spend the rest of our life with or have a child or whatever it is for us. And on another level, what has been extremely powerful for me in contemplating the material in this class has been deepening my recognition that what we call death is actually part of a continuum. You know, we could say that when the body dies, the different aspects of our being return to the domain with which they resonate. So the physical body goes into the earth, and the mind enters a subtler realm. But the traditions that we're drawing on assume that physical death is not the end, nor is your experience in that subtle realm. Because most of us will end up with another body, not all of us, but some of us, and that our human body, with every successive life, is a vehicle for the refinement of our soul, not only for working out karmas, but also for maturing into a nuanced recognition of this fundamental paradox of being a human being, which is that we are so multi-leveled, that we have an individuated consciousness, an individual consciousness, which is unique and specific and like no other consciousness, soul in the universe. And we're also, I like to call it slices or aspects within this vast field of absolute consciousness. So as individuals, each of us belongs to what many traditions say is a karmically determined family and tribe, which apparently is much bigger and much subtler than we even know in this life, because not all the members of that tribe are here. And we also, of course, carry our predispositions, our characteristics, the qualities that define our nature as individuals, and also what some traditions consider the innate qualities of our soul. In other words, we may be the kind of soul, might have the kind of nature to be a warrior or the kind of nature to be a creator, you know, and a person who likes to work with materials and make things. Or we might be a performer. You know, there are many different ways that souls manifest, many different kind of soul personalities that we have. And, of course, we also have the baggage, some of it very beautiful, some of it not so nice, that we've carried from lifetimes. And this is all very real, especially when we're living it. But once we start to really look deeply at our experience, especially when we are, you know, in the second half of a long life, it becomes quite obvious that we're inside a kind of waking dream. In other words, things have been changing, sometimes changing radically, ever since our early childhood, and the change is escalating. And then a lot of it has this kind of evanescent quality, because when you meditate, you can start to have the experience that both your body and your physical surroundings are evanescent, and that your very identity is far from being as solid as you thought. So in sadhana, we really, sooner or later, learn how to hold this paradox, because it is one of the reasons that we do spiritual practice, to really recognize that our particular history and psychological style and karmic tendencies is both something that we need to engage because it's determining so much of our experience, And at the same time, it's passing and temporary. And of course, it's a lot easier to know this if we're a little bit familiar with quantum physics, you know, with one of the contemporary kind of mind-blowing views about parallel universes and the evanescent, ever-changing nature of the quantum field. But most of us need constant practice to hold on to these paradoxes of how we can simultaneously exist as physical beings and as subtle beings. And for me, understanding my subtlety has been the most powerful antidote to the fear of dying. And it also has been very important in understanding dying to the degree that any of us are able to. We need to begin to make sense of some of the different perspectives, both on the process of dying and on the world we enter at death. So I have chosen throughout this course to focus on the subtler aspects of dying and of the after-death experience, partly because it's, to be completely self-disclosing, it's what I'm most interested in, but partly because I do think that we tend to be so confused about the different views we can take about what happens at death. You know, our minds are such a mishmash of early religious training or early materialist training. I certainly grew up in a context in which nobody believed that anything happened after death except your body decomposed. So to begin to have a perspective about it I find it's really important to start to look at and meditate on the actual experiences and accounts of experience that have come down from sages in the traditions, as well as from some of the work that goes on today in post-hypnotic remembrance. I also, one of the reasons I chose to kind of be subtle is because there's really a lot of good information now about the physical processes of dying. Much of it from medically trained people or hospice workers or teachers whose main mission has been working with the sick and the dying. So we're not going to go in very deeply to the very important areas of working with the physical aspects of, for instance, being present with someone who's sick or our own illness. But I want to touch some of the practical bases, what we need to do IRL in real life. I love that phrase from the millennial and post-millennial world. IRL in real life being an actual category as opposed to life online. There are several really important actions that we can take now and that we're entering into in this class, whatever age we are, but especially, say, if you're over 50, that help make the process of dying much easier and much less stressful, and also takes a certain amount of fear out of the mind of anyone. You know, even if you have 50, 60 more years of healthy life, it's still great to have taken care of your, so to speak, loose ends as you go along. So the first thing to consider seriously is your unfinished business, and there's several layers of it. And, of course, one of them is the very nitty-gritty practical issues like making a will, having conversations with family members about your medical wishes, figuring out who's going to hold your power of attorney and your medical proxy if you ever get too sick to make decisions. All the books that I've ever read, and I'm sure that you've read about end-of-life issues, say again and again how important it is to do this even if you're young, even if you're quite young, because you literally never know when a sudden accident or a serious illness is going to take decisions out of your hands. And, you know, I just read a piece today on Apple News, which says that a guy who ran a Bitcoin vault died suddenly without having given his password to anybody, so everyone who had Bitcoin in that vault has no access to it. this kind of thing actually happens quite a bit. So probably not on that scale. But, you know, there are the checklists that Jackie gave you, the checklists that are available on many websites and in many books now, really give you a sense of what you might need to put in place on a very real-world practical level. Ideally, we go through life doing our very best to tidy up our unfinished business, whether it's by contemplating regret and forgiveness, whether it has to do with looking into our relationships, but also the stuff that we've been putting off. And, you know, there are a lot of things that, because of the press of life and business, we sort of think we're going to do later, which could be something like taking a trip to South America or start writing a memoir or taking a bold new step in your career or going into therapy. You know, there are a lot of things that we somehow know we would enjoy or find beneficial that we don't do because we're too busy or we don't feel like we deserve it. So part of what we really want to do as we go along and what I hope you'll be inspired to do is start to resolve as much as possible your sense of unlived life, which I think is probably the main source of regret for many people. And also to begin to, let's say, take care of your karmic debts. Because one of the teachings of the traditions, especially the Indian and Tibetan traditions, is that karma is essentially debt. So our karma, you know, the karma that we take with us, is very often the result of kind of unpaid debts, not just financial, obviously, but often much subtler debts, whether with other people or with ourselves. So something that I've started to do in my 50s, and which maybe some of you do already, is not just reconnect with old friends on Facebook, but actually think of the people who were meaningful to me or whom I have a sense of charge with, and contact them and kind of do what we can do to acknowledge and recognize each other. Sometimes you have to be careful about this. I decided about 15 years ago that I wanted to reconnect with someone I'd been very, very close to when I was a young woman, who's about 15 years older than me, and I think I was 50 at the time, so he would have been 65, which I thought was extremely old. And when I asked, he asked me why I had decided to contact him at that exact moment. I just blurted out, well, I wanted to make sure that we had one more conversation, you know, in case you die. And he was borderline miffed, because what I didn't realize is that 65-year-old people generally don't think of themselves as being about to die. So if you're attempting to complete some karmic relationships, you don't necessarily need to tell people that that's what you're doing. Another thing, of course, that many of you have been doing for years is to write gratitude letters. And I like to write letters because sometimes it's kind of embarrassing to say these things face to face. But also because if you write a letter, somebody can read it over and over again, and when they're having a low moment, you know, somebody, for instance, who was your teacher in sixth grade, which is one of the people that I wrote a letter to, at the time, I didn't know it, but he had early stage Alzheimer's, and getting a letter from a former student, even though he, I'm sure, didn't remember which of his students I was, his wife told me, enormously meaningful to him. So it makes a big difference. And even though a lot of us have done this, have done gratitude practice and forgiveness practice, you can always take a deeper cut, especially when it comes to your issues with your parents, where so much of our karmic entanglement, indebtedness, anger, grief, resentment reside. I have a friend who, when she was in her early 20s, she took the landmark forearm training. And as you know, if you've ever done that training, one of the things they say is that if you can't forgive your parents, you can't make progress in life. So, and they make you, on one of the weekends, they make you get up during the break and call your parents. So this friend of mine managed to talk her way out of having to actually pick up her phone and make the call. But she had to promise that she would call her parents the following week. And so 2 days after the workshop, as she was driving home to make this call, she ran her car into a telephone pole and totaled it, and would laugh afterwards saying that she would rather wreck her car than tell her parents that she forgave and loved them. So there are often many layers, and she did that later on in life. She took another swipe at it, and I think quite successfully, if you're wondering how this story ends. But, you know, I've also found that writing letters asking for forgiveness, especially from people whom you feel hurt you, can be quite a powerful form of turning the other cheek. And it doesn't have to be passive aggressive. For me, one of the most powerful things I did in this realm was writing to my father, asking for his forgiveness. And it was a big deal for me because, you know, I like most children, I blamed him for whatever had gone wrong in our relationship. And in the process of writing that letter, I started to consider not just how I might have been somewhat difficult to have as a daughter, but also who he was as a human being, not in relationship to me, and how much he actually gave up in order to be a parent. And he had 5 children. So it was not an easy thing for him, even though he didn't have to do the housework. But I think that the process of expressing gratitude and asking forgiveness for, and it doesn't have to be for anything specific. It could be just kind of a blanket, you know, if there is any way in which I hurt or offended you, I ask forgiveness. I hope we can move past it. It's a tremendously heart-melting thing to do for yourself, and it's also a very powerful way of wiping out karmic entanglements. So if you can't do this, if you can't contact the person or talk to them, whether because they're not alive in the body or because your relationship is not such that you can really have that conversation, you can also do it subtly. And I want to do a practice right now that some of you have done with me before that I have found to be really extremely powerful in working with karmic issues between yourself and another person. So as we start, choose somebody with whom you have some unfinished business, and it doesn't have to be someone you never see. It can be someone in your office or someone in your family. Anyone with whom there is a certain feeling of unfinished stuff. Maybe you've tried to talk to them about it, maybe you haven't. Maybe you have talked to them about it, but there's still some unprocessed feelings of grievance or estrangement. Or maybe this is one of those people that, you know, you think is impossible to talk to. But just choose that person. And now imagine, this is actually a very good practice to do seated in a place where you can close your eyes. Imagine that you are with this person in a very beautiful natural spot. Maybe a garden or a place by the beach, by the water. And you're seated, you're comfortably seated, you're facing each other. You've actually have the feeling that you have invited this person here in order to resolve any issues that there might be between you, but you're not necessarily going to do it by talking. Instead, you're going to give this person a flower, which a flower being in the language of symbols, one of the most powerful symbols for your intention, for peace, for understanding. So imagine a flower in your hand. Imagine it being held in your two hands and give it to the person you're with. Imagine them taking it, looking at it. And in all active imaginations, of course, there may not be an active visualization. But recognize that this is a practice that can really have a very deep effect on the atmosphere between you and the other person. See if it feels that the flower has been accepted. You may want to offer another one. And this subtle meeting ground, we're going to do it as a homework assignment later on this week. It's actually a very good venue to have meaningful and even difficult conversations in, which we're not going to do now because we have some other practices that we want to do. But there are a lot of things that you can say in that situation and a lot of things that you can hear from your friend, which is quite surprising. So in this process of completing unfinished business, I want to refer to a very famous passage in the Vedic texts of India, in which obligation is discussed. And it's said that we owe 5 natural debts, that as soon as we come into life, we acquire these debts. They're natural. The first one is our debt to the higher beings, to the light powers who are seen in the tradition as governors of the world. And we repay those debts with remembrance, with mantras, with invocation, with ceremony. When we chant the invocation, Om Namah Shivaya Gurave, at the beginning of this class, what we are actually doing is acknowledging and honoring our debt to higher beings. The second natural debt is our debt to the sages, which we fulfill through spiritual practice, through study, by especially studying texts that describe the sacred nature of the world, by honoring those who give us spiritual knowledge, and by seriously making an attempt to follow the practices and the view of life, the view of the world that comes down from the great non-dual sages. You know, and I want to say, even though I know most of you know this, is that honoring the sages or paying your debt to the sages is not the same thing as mindlessly following religious orthodoxy or, you know, keeping the rules that your religious tradition may have laid down. It's also not kind of magical thinking or assuming that everything your teacher says or does is something that you have to accede to. You know, at certain stages of practice, we often have to put aside doubts temporarily so we can test whether a practice is going to work for you. But even when you're holding the teachings up to your experience and learning to discriminate between which practices come from superstition or dogma, and those that actually let you live with more compassion, it's very important to realize that the presence of these beings who have really tried to teach the truth in their generations and that have come down to us is tremendously important in maintaining this world. So the third natural debt is the debt to the ancestors. And of course, there's a lot to this. A lot of it involves how you treat your parents, how you how you come to terms with your parents. And as we said earlier, some of that, certainly for those of us in the West, probably means letting go of grievances. But you also pay back your debts to your parents by paying it forward. In other words, what the Vedas say is that when we have children, we are repaying our ancestors for everything they did to bring us to life. And if we don't have children or can't have children, then we repay our ancestral debts by helping children in whatever way we can, being of help to the next generations. And there also, in many traditional cultures, there are specific times of year, days of the year, and specific rituals in which people make offerings to the ancestors, which again may seem, let's say, formal or not like something that you could ever imagine yourself doing, but which actually are, again, this is data that comes from people who have been in connection with the realms in which people who are not in human bodies anymore may be living. They're helpful. And an offering or a kind thought or appreciation that we direct to someone who's no longer in this world actually helps their legacy. It helps their evolution, believe it or not. It helps rid them of issues that they might not have dealt with in this life. And I want to say something here about suicide, because it's one of the questions that always comes up when we start talking about these issues, and which for most of us, you know, most of us know people who've committed suicide, sometimes people very close to us. And we ourselves might have considered suicide at different points in life. So obviously the traditions do not, they don't have a particularly positive attitude about suicide. And there are obvious reasons for this, because the human body is actually very precious. But if you start to break down what the case-by-case understanding about suicide is in the more enlightened phases of the traditions, you see that it is very much about case-by-case, and that the main argument against suicide is that it doesn't really work. In other words, if you kill yourself because you're suffering and your karma hasn't been completed, you're probably going to have to experience some part of that karma in the afterlife or in the next world. But on the other hand, when a suicide comes out of, you know, extreme depression, or when it's something that a person does in order to spare the people around them trouble, you know, as when someone is terminally ill and does a elective, you know, self-administered death process, it can be a very rational and compassionate decision, both for yourself and for other people. And what I wanted to share with you is conversations that I've had with friends who have had children or close people who've killed themselves. A couple of people whom I know who've done very deep meditation practice on this issue and managed to connect to, I'm thinking specifically about a friend whose son killed himself during an episode of depression. His son was bipolar. It was obviously one of the biggest, you know, most difficult tragedies of this person's life. And he'd worried about it. He'd worried about his son for many years, because he was a practicing Hindu and had read that suicide is just not a good thing to do, clearly, in terms of future karma. So during a meditation retreat, he made a very, very big prayer in meditation and found himself that night seeing his son in a dream. And it was one of those dreams where you actually feel like you're in contact with something other than your own subconscious. And in it, he saw his son, who was quite radiant, seemed very happy, and said to his father over and over again, "You don't have to worry about me. Everything is fine. You don't have to worry about me. I'm fine. I'm moving on, and I'm fine." So this is one of the areas in which we really need to understand that that especially in regard to not projecting our fear and worry and grief onto people who have passed on, but actually sending them loving thoughts, practicing and dedicating our practice to them. So this ancestor practice is actually very significant and powerful for every one of us, even if we don't feel connected to an ancestor. The truth is that we are, and we can improve our own condition as well as theirs by making offerings, especially offerings of kind thoughts and love. The fourth debt, which I'm not going to talk about as much as it deserves, is the debt we owe to the earth, to the elements, to the animal kingdom, to the plant kingdom, which we honor, of course, by taking care of the natural world and by taking care of the animals and plants and other beings that inhabit it. So obviously this is something that we have tended to neglect in modern times, and that each one of us has, I believe, a very deep wish to be a giver in this sense, to be of help to the earth, to be a healer of the earth rather than an exploiter. And for every one of us, there are ways in which we can do this that go with us, that are appropriate for us, both personally and, you know, and in terms of how we look at the way we use resources. So our fifth debt is our obligation to other human beings, which we honor by welcoming guests, by helping other people through whatever means we can, by acts of generosity, and also by the way we speak about other people, which I want to mention because, you know, as you know, the violence with which we express disagreement or with which we gossip about other people in our life is actually extremely destructive, not just to them, but also to us, to our own spirit. So actually disciplining yourself to think well of other people and speak well of other people is quite a big deal when it comes to our obligation to other people. It is not just a question of feeding our guests, so that is a beautiful thing to do. It's a question of teaching ourselves to think well of them. And by the way, one of the benefits of chanting mantra is that it purifies the energy in our speech and helps us to open. And then there's our debt to ourself, our debt to our personal embodied self, and also our debt to our deep self, to our so-called true self. Because when we begin to seriously contemplate death, when we start to think, okay, death is sitting on my shoulder, as Don Juan says in the famous Castaneda books of the 1970s, which some of you are too young to have read. One of the things that we need to make up for, really, is the ways we held back our hearts or didn't step up to be fully present with another person, but also the ways in which we haven't been present to ourselves, which could be a question of not fully living up to your potential, the feeling that you could be more open to taking risks that might help you expand your heart or expand your skills, ways of looking at the imbalances that we've allowed to be present between ourselves and other people, really looking at what is often called the unlived life, the ways in which our choices have created circumstances in which we might like to adjust now. And so it then becomes very important to look at what we can do now because there does come a point in life where we need to accept that there were certain things we wanted that we didn't accomplish or that we didn't receive. But often when we really look at it, we see that there's a lot that we can do to rebalance. This is, again, it's something that we want to start to look at in our own contemplation. What can you do to live some part of your unlived life? It's a very, very helpful contemplation. And what I want to come back to is the truth that for most of us, the imbalance that we need to correct is the imbalance of our material concerns and our inner work, which, you know, given the nature of modern life and given the responsibilities that we have and you know, just how hard it is for most people to make a living and raise a family and do a few creative projects, it's very easy to get imbalanced in our inner work. And that said, some of us are very deep in our inner work and our imbalance is in the physical world. So again, this is case by case. But in approaching the practices that we want to make truly a part of our ongoing life, with the idea that these are practices that enhance our capacity to live fully as an individual being, and also help us when we die, and which through the power of aspiration and the power of habit and the power of planting what is sometimes called white seeds or seeds of positive karma. There's a couple of practices that I feel are really, really gold star, really, really deeply positive and helpful. And one of them, which I'd like to encourage you to make a commitment to exploring in the next couple of weeks, is the incredibly potent and transformative practice of Tonglen, or sending and taking, in which we deliberately and consciously breathe in suffering, darkness, discomfort, our own and that of others, connect it in the heart, and then deliberately and intentionally breathe out light and compassion from the heart. If you have Buddhist friends or have practiced Buddhism yourself or read Pema Chodron's books, you'll be familiar with this practice. I also teach a version of it. It's tremendously transformative, even if you only practice it with your own suffering, and even more transformative when you do it for yourself, for someone else, and for the world. So Tonglen means sending, taking and sending. It's a practice where we start by cultivating a felt sense of compassion and then breathe in the suffering we encounter while breathing out our happiness, our light, and our peace into the person who's suffering, which could be our own mind. So at first glance, this is a tremendously counterintuitive practice, and a lot of us are scared to do it because, understandably, we want to disperse the negative. We want to breathe it out. We want to free ourselves from it. And we want to avoid taking on negativity from others. You know, especially spiritual people who tend to be quite sensitive, quite open, often have a kind of unpleasant experience of unintentionally taking on the negativity from their surroundings. And, you know, it's sometimes hard to know where our uncomfortable feelings come from. And it's very good to know how to disengage ourselves from the negativity in an environment, to disperse negative energy, and to create energetic boundaries for ourselves. There's very definitely a place for this kind of experience. So practicing Tonglen and cultivating Tonglen and cultivating compassion doesn't mean that you now have an obligation to take on all the negativity from your family or from your environment, not at all. But to choose to do a formal practice of Tonglen, especially when you begin, It's a very simple and immediate way to accomplish a huge amount of inner work. So here are a couple of the reasons why it's such a powerful practice. First, it helps dispel fear, which, you know, whenever we feel like we want to separate ourselves from something or that we are separate from the rest of the world, there is a natural fear. So allowing ourselves to take in suffering and breathe out our own happiness to others begins to erode the boundaries that create fear. At a much deeper level, what it does is help us open past the ego's self-protective aversion to anything that doesn't feel good, to anything that feels bad, whether it's an internal feeling or something that we see outside. Tonglen helps us recognize our unbreakable connection with others, and this helps us tune into natural compassion. And, of course, it's enormously helpful in allowing us to be present with people who are hurting, whether it's through psychological pain or physical pain or any of the countless ways in which the people around us experience loss. So, you know, obviously, many of us are aware of how averse we are to pain and how trying to keep pain at a distance or detach ourselves from it actually adds an extra dimension of suffering to what's already going on. And our aversion may be quite intense, as when you blame other people for your own suffering, which is something that all humans do at one time or another. It also often shows up as just plain irritation at the discomfort you're experiencing or as a need to distract yourself in all the ways that we modern humans get to do. If you've ever had chronic physical pain, as I know some of you have, you know how there's this simmering undercurrent of irritability that seems to go along with the pain unless we consciously work with it. And there's another way that our aversion to suffering shows up, which is in a kind of relentless positivity where you just refuse to acknowledge that anything is wrong. And many of us have had that experience in our own family. And it actually is one of the reasons why the bardo of dying can be so difficult, because there will be family members and people who just want to distance themselves from the unpleasantness. So practicing Tonglen actually helps you to get through these very human and natural aversions. And it's a tremendously powerful way of working with your own stuff. The first time I ever did this seriously was during a weekend when I don't even remember what it is that had happened. I think there was some kind of exterior event, but I was really, really mad and was not successfully releasing my anger. So I decided I would do Tonglen with it, and I sat down and began to follow actually Pema Chodron's instructions. If you're a beginner at this practice, she, in several of her books, she gives a step-by-step Tonglen practice, which starts out by breathing, having you breathe in dark, hot energy, or even the colors of the colors like dark red, you know, the colors that indicate anger, or or deep, kind of yellowish gray, which is often a color that goes with depression. So you breathe in difficult colors, and then you imagine yourself breathing out light. So, you start by doing it as a kind of a visualization, and then you take it further. And I began breathing in my anger, and then I brought someone to mind who I considered a very angry person and began breathing in his anger. And then I allowed my mind to roam over all the people that I could summon to in my imagination who had good reasons for being angry. And it was astonishing to me how many pockets of angry people I became aware of. You know, people who've lived for generations in refugee camps, jobless young men trapped in poverty, married couples who can't stand each other, fast food workers working for minimum wage under crowded conditions. And I was, as I brought to mind the anger of all these people and all these groups of people, I also found myself breathing in all the reasons why they had good reason to be angry. So it was like a inner darshan of injustice and cruelty and rage. And as I was breathing in these different pockets of anger and breathing out light and peace and my own interior, let's call it the fruits of my years of spiritual practice, which are always there for us when we start to encounter them, when we start to turn towards them, I began to realize that the anger that I was feeling was not my anger. It was the anger. In other words, personal anger, no matter how justified it may seem or no matter how specific it may seem, is actually part of the pool of anger that simmers in the noosphere, the realm of mind that we all share, that subtle atmosphere that we all participate in. And that collective field has its pockets of anger, its pockets of grief, its pockets of pride, its pockets of jealousy. It's almost as though the archetypes of these feelings are present in the mind field. And when our personal emotional life connects us to those feelings inside, it also seems to connect us, whether we know it or not, to the feelings in the collective. So working with them in a deliberate way is, for one thing, a very powerful way of changing your identification with your negative emotions. And it also, and again, if you've done this practice, you know what I'm talking about, and hopefully you will discover it as we go on, is that when you are willing to meet negativity with affection, to breathe back affection into the negativity, it starts to unlock the reservoir of love and compassion that is also part of the mind field, you know, the love that's utterly available in the collective field, that actually is the energy that holds, that's present behind the negativity. Let's take a deep breath in and start to cultivate once again the cave of the heart. So feel as though the breath is flowing into the heart cave. And that as the breath flows out, it flows out with a sense that from within the heart, the field of unconditional love is being kindled through the breath and is flowing through your own body. In Buddhism, the phrase that is used to talk about the heart, the compassionate heart, is bodhicitta. Bodhi meaning awakened or awake, meaning enlightened. And citta meaning the field of your own consciousness. So bodhicitta is really awakened consciousness. And by awakened, they mean a consciousness that has steeped itself in compassion, in natural compassion. So bodhicitta practice, which Tonglen is one example, is what we do to cultivate and bring forth compassion from within the heart. And the thing about practicing compassion is that it works even if we're feeling hard-hearted. And if we're feeling hard-hearted or in grief or in loss or in depression or in any state that cuts us off from the feeling of connection to love, the cultivation that we do is really going to change it for us. This is what is called relative bodhicitta, the tenderness of heart that arises towards another person, which over time, as your sense of oneness becomes stronger, will lead to a state that is called absolute bodhicitta, which arises when your sense of separation dissolves, either momentarily or permanently. And I know that some of you have had that experience of absolute bodhicitta, where you're just able to feel the non-difference between yourself and everyone else. The experience of compassion that bodhicitta refers to can be heart-wrenching. It can be heart-wrenching and heart-melting at the same time. It also is very different than pity, which is nearly always a distancing emotion. Stephen Levine, who's one of the great experts on working with the dying, wrote, "When your fear touches another's pain, it becomes pity. When your love touches another's pain, it becomes compassion." And I think that's a very, very good way of describing it. We're going to do a couple of practices for rousing compassion, which you will be familiar with. And then we're going to do a formal tonglen. We'll just start by remembering a time when you felt loved. Remembering a time when you felt loved. Thinking of a moment in your life, could be very small or it could have been a big one, where you felt completely accepted, held, and cherished. And bring that person in that situation to mind. Focus on that feeling of receiving love. And then very softly, see if you can let that feeling flow out towards the person whom triggered that feeling of love. Or towards another person. Inhaling the feeling of being loved and exhaling that love outward. And if it's hard to remember a time of feeling loved, you can use words, "May I be loved. May I be held. May I be happy. May I be free of suffering." And this, of course, is the classic loving kindness meditation. And really give yourself this, because it's the compassion and kindness we feel for ourselves that is one of the chief resources for offering it to someone else. And from this place of feeling into your own compassionate heart, now imagine somebody who's in pain, someone you know, whether it's emotional pain or physical pain, and put yourself in their place. Imagine that you're inside their body and see if you can allow yourself for a moment, not losing your connection to the kindness that you've kindled in your heart. See if you can imagine what it feels like to be that person. Notice the experience in your body. Ask yourself, how would you want someone to be with you if you were feeling like that, if you were that person. And then come back to your own heart, to the heart cave. And I want to say that every 2 seconds of letting yourself feel into another person's pain is giving a blessing. It's giving a blessing to yourself and it's giving a blessing to them. And while I don't suggest that you histrionically bring yourself into feeling other people's pain, I do advocate, and I've found myself, that when you read a story about someone who's suffering, and I think we can think of many, whether it's the refugees on the southern borders or in refugee camps all over Europe and the Middle East, or people in prisons or people in the ICU and hospitals in your town, or someone in your own house. Every moment when we can cultivate that and let your heart be touched with it, it's going to help deepen your experience of your capacity for compassion. So Shantideva, one of the great exponents of Mahayana Buddhism, says of bodhicitta, of awakened compassion, "It is the supreme elixir that overcomes the sovereignty of death. It is the inexhaustible treasure that eliminates poverty in the world. It is the supreme medicine that quells the world's disease. It is the tree that shelters all beings wandering and tired on the path of conditioned existence. It is the universal bridge that leads to freedom from unhappy states of birth. It is the great sun that finally removes the misty ignorance of the world." The opposite of bodhicitta is egoic selfishness, which is pretty much the cause of all our karmic pickles. And one of the reasons why we come into these human bodies is to learn about compassion, about unconditional love, about our belonging. With this in mind, let's begin a Tonglen practice. You can stand and stretch. We'll do a short version. And we'll take some questions. So really take a moment to stretch, shake your body out, and then take a seat. So the essence of Tonglen is to breathe in bad feelings, your bad feelings, your dark feelings, your painful feelings, and breathe out light, happy ones, whether you do it as a feeling practice, an energy practice, or as a visualization practice. It's quite counterintuitive. And in beginning it, it's very, very helpful to create a sense of the resource, the feeling of clarity or light in the body. And today we're practicing with the heart. We're practicing with the heart cave. Let's start by inhaling into the heart. Following the breath. Feeling that the inhaled breath is filled with particles of light and affection and kindness that you're inhaling into your heart. And the exhaled breath is letting that kind feeling, that loving feeling, spread through your whole chest. For some of you, the most powerful way to do this will be by inhaling the mantra. Let yourself breathe in Namah Shivaya as an offering into the heart. Namah Shivaya flowing through the whole chest. Have the feeling that the cave of your own heart is filled with light, with depth, with radiance, and with refuge. It's a place where you can take seat, where you can be fully interior, where you can hold yourself, and where you can begin to draw on the reserves of your own love and compassion, your own light. So imagine now that the hurt, angry, suffering, karmically challenged part of yourself, perhaps the wounded child or the bitter part of you, the unhappy, self-blaming part of you, imagine that this form of yourself is seated in front of you. Your eyes are closed, obviously, and you're imagining your suffering self sitting before you. See if you can tune into the feelings in this part of yourself and begin to breathe them in like a stream into the cave of the heart. So you're sitting inside your awakened self, inside your heartfelt self, breathing in the suffering of your frightened, unhappy, karmically challenged, perhaps narcissistic, suffering self. Inhale those feelings, whatever they are, into the heart cave, and then with the exhalation, imagine that light, that love, that presence that kindness, that peace flows from your heart and enters the heart of this suffering form of yourself. This whole being that is you opens her heart, opens his heart to the part of you that's in pain. Draws in the suffering and breathes out compassion, affection, peacefulness, the feeling of complete worthiness. Full acceptance, healing. Everything that you've cultivated in your own heart over the years, you're making an offering to the suffering part of yourself. Now, instead of the figure representing yourself sitting in front of you, imagine that there is a friend, or a relative, someone whom you know to be unhappy or sick, someone who's in pain. Imagine that person sitting in front of you. Just take a moment to make the decision of who it is that you're going to practice with. And feel that you get an immediate, bright sense of that person and their pain. And then begin to inhale their pain, their suffering, into the cave of your own heart. And we're going to add a piece to this. Feel as though that pain, the person, the other person's pain, enters your heart in the form of dark smoke. Feel that dark smoke of their suffering penetrating the core of your own egotistical feeling of separation. As though the pain of the other person hits you like an arrow and enters right into your core egotism. Feel it dissolving layer upon layer of your grasping, egoic, lower nature. And feel that as this grasping dissolves, even just a little bit, your open, compassionate heart is revealed as a powerful light and love. And then with the next exhalation, feel that compassionate, loving light flowing from your heart and entering your friend. Imagine it dissolving layers of their negative karmas. And then with the next inhalation, breathe in the residuals of their suffering into your own heart and breathe out light and love and compassion back to them. With great openness and courage, take in their pain. Let it penetrate the knot of grasping in your own heart. And feel the release of luminosity in your heart now flowing through your body. So that when you exhale, you're exhaling loving luminosity into the person across from you. See if you can see your friend irradiated by the light that you've been offering them. Notice if you can feel a loosening of the boundaries, a sense of non-separation. And now let go of the image of this individual. And begin to allow your attention to roam over situations in the world where you feel there is enormous suffering, physical, mental, pockets of despair, cold, illness, Let your mind enter those situations. And then with your next inhalation, breathe in the atmosphere, the suffering, the pain, the anger, the grief, the despair. Breathe it into the heart cave. Breathe it in as dark smoke. Breathe it in as emotional intensity. Breathe it into the heart. And breathe out love, light, and luminosity from your heart into that situation. Find the rhythm of it. Taking in the felt sense of pain, letting it enter and penetrate your heart, and breathing back tenderness, light, compassion, acceptance, affection. Noticing how that in the very act of doing this, in the very act of breathing in pain and breathing out love, breathing out joy, something is being transmuted in your own heart field. You can find another situation if you like and begin to take in that suffering. Take it into your heart and allow the ground of love and joy in your heart flow out with the exhalation into that situation. With the next inhalation, bring yourself fully into the cave of your own heart and make a dedication. Ask that this practice and the merit of this practice become a blessing that deepens the capacity for enlightenment in all beings. Make this offering of the love that you have been willing to offer and the merit that comes with that offering for the sake of all suffering beings. And we're going to just sit for a moment and feel into the inner effect of that practice. Just feel how your heart feels, feel how your body feels. Noticing that as you begin to cultivate this series of feelings and practices, lots of stuff may come up. And all of it can be breathed into the heart, offered into the heart, and then the heart can offer affection back to whatever it is that you're experiencing in this moment. So we have some time for questions. And I think there are probably some questions on the web that Deb might bring forth for us, but also you can raise your hand if you have a question. And Deb will facilitate calling on you. Press star 2 to raise your hand, and Deb will unmute you.
We don't have any questions tonight on the Q&A.
Everyone's stunned. So if you have a question or something that you'd like to share with us about what that practice that we've just done or any of the practices we've done tonight, how it's landed for you, what you experienced, you can also, you also welcome that. So star 2.
I will say that this is Deb. I've been listening to all of this in the middle of getting texts from my son that there is an active shooter at his campus. So,
oh my God!
I just thought,
oh my God,
this is
wow.
Like, you know, I'm like, he's safe, you know, he's safe, and his, it's actually in the hall where his Air Force group meets, and but they happen to be off campus tonight. But
wow.
Yeah, so it was kind of like, okay, this is a little kind of cosmic.
Close to home.
Yeah.
Wow.
So
wow.
Let's see if we,
wow. So let's inhale that for just a minute before the next question. Let's just breathe in that fear and anger and send light and blessing to it through the heart. Okay.
Thank you. That's a little bit of grounding
wow.
there.
Yeah.
So Karen has a question from the on the list. She says, I thought I heard you mention the importance of asking forgiveness, especially from people who have hurt us. If they have hurt us, what are we asking them to forgive? Or did I misunderstand?
No, you didn't misunderstand. Because, well, I'll tell you where I'm coming from with this. This is a very skillful practice that's related to Jesus' extremely mystical teaching about turning the other cheek. Because if you can actually have the humility to ask forgiveness from someone who has hurt you. And I'm talking here about serious relationships, not somebody casual. But because there is no such thing as an unmotivated piece of cruelty, in other words, there's always something that somebody else is using as a grievance, whether it's justified or not. And when you look at how you yourself may have hurt, said, thought something about that other person, that in some way diminishes their humanity, and ask forgiveness, it really shifts your sense of being a victim. And by the way, you don't have to send the letter. You can just write the letter and use it as a contemplation. But it's often very powerful to send the letter, because if the person that you're sending it to is not, you know, just a complete psychopath, it usually will trigger a contemplation in them and kind of open their hearts and begin to make it possible for them to actually look at the ways in which they might have hurt you without feeling guilt-tripped about it. So in that sense, it's a very skillful interpersonal practice. And thank you for asking the question. You know, the teaching of turn the other cheek, which is often very hard to understand, is very similar to a Buddhist recognition practice, which comes from the Lojong teachings that are, you know, a very, very beautiful set of practices for cultivating an awakened mind, actually. And it says, take all blames into one. So what that means is open your heart to recognizing that the hurt that seems to come towards you is actually nobody's fault. The hurt that seems to come towards you is a product of the collective hurt that sometimes lands on you, sometimes lands on another person. And what it is to turn the other cheek is to recognize that the hurt that people deliver is coming out of their own pain. The cruelty that other people deliver is coming out of their own pain. And it doesn't mean that you don't do everything you can to right wrongs. But it also means that you take on yourself some recognition of what it is that creates hurtfulness. And even when that hurtfulness has been directed towards you. So I'm going to ask you to just kind of sit in this paradox for a minute or two. Because it's quite a profound and transformative thing to contemplate. It's not about blaming yourself for the terrible things that have happened to you, not at all. It's about recognizing that all of us participate both as victims and also as perpetrators, that we're all implicated, and that we all can ask forgiveness and be forgiven on a much deeper level than we know. So, any other questions or sharing or reactions to the practice that we just did?
Karen just said thank you. She gets it so deep. Thank you. And
yes, thank
oh, we
you.
Do have a question here. I just someone in maybe Oakland, California. If you raised your hand, pick up.
Hi, this is Lakshmi.
Hi, Lakshmi.
Hi.
How are you? Hi.
Hi. I'm okay. I've been loving this class, so thank you. I found that during the Tonglen, I have when we did the individual practice, I have a dear friend who's just had a lot of things going on in her whole life and the last 20 years, and her mom was recently diagnosed with an aggressive cancer. And so I found it very easy to let her suffering, that arrow, I was kind of surprised by the direction you gave, but to the smoke and have it the arrow and penetrate the ego. And I really actually felt that and a kind of a melting of some things. But when we started to go to the other sufferings, of which there's so much, and part of one of the situations that I brought to mind was every time I go to visit my father in the place where he's living, in this assisted living, I feel like I'm constantly practicing Tonglen because there's so much suffering. And
right.
I found it actually really hard to let that same kind of penetrative arrow come in, like it could come in to a certain extent, but I really felt like a boundary of that it couldn't go beyond, it couldn't kind of pierce. And I don't necessarily think that's a problem, but and then when I shifted to some other situations too, where I can really feel the suffering, but it didn't have that same kind of arrow effect. And I just wondered if you could speak to that maybe a little bit.
Sure. My intuition is that because you're personally, you have strong personal affection for the friend that you are working with, that the specificity of her suffering could have that piercing quality. Whereas when you do it in a more general way, there's often a little bit of abstraction and distance. You know, so I actually don't think it's necessary to feel the piercing of the ego knot every time. But what's more important is to get into the rhythm of rather than distancing or trying to push away or be averse to the discomfort of recognizing suffering, that you just let it in and then really have the intention to breathe out light and love and affection to it, and let that process do its work, which can be very, very subtle. So I have had this experience also, that it's actually more powerful when I'm working with individuals that I know, mainly because I'm so familiar with their pain. And it's more abstract when I'm trying to work with the situation. So maybe what you might want to do is imagine an actual person in one of those situations and, you know, practice that way so that it's more personal and less abstract. And, you know, also just know that, you know, and I know you've done this practice in different forms, as many of you have, just know that every time you do it, it's releasing strains of karma in you, and it's also giving something to the people that you're breathing it into. So it's whatever the effect is in a given moment, it's going to be powerful. It's going to be liberating. So Lakshmi, thank you.
Yeah, thank you so much.
We've got a couple more questions that came up. Catherine asks, Sally, I noticed a concern about taking on someone's state karma in this process of breathing in and visualizing their pain.
Yes.
Maybe that's more of a statement.
Yes. So this is one of the reasons why this practice is so good at pulverizing the ego knot, because we have so much fear of taking in somebody else's karmic pain. And, you know, this fear, which I think we all have, I certainly have it myself, is something that this practice directly aims at dissolving. So I actually don't think it's that easy to take on somebody else's karma. You know, you have to have a pretty powerful consciousness to be able to do that, even with intention. But what mostly happens with this process, with this practice, is that we begin to obliterate the sense of distance between our own consciousness and that of another. And the blessing that we send to them, it, you know, if we're really entering into this practice, is not coming from a kind of distance, oh, I'm a good person and I'm going to send some blessing to this terrible situation. It much more begins to be from a soft recognition that it really is you. I mean, even though your karma is very different, it's still you. It's still your karma. And again, that's something that this practice begins to open up, and it also begins to open up the fear that, you know, that we'll catch some karmic disease from our practice of offering blessings. It doesn't really work like that. And And at the same time, as our consciousness becomes stronger, you know, most of us probably aren't in that state now, but at some point as we keep very seriously practicing on this path, our willingness to take in and dissolve somebody's karma, because that's really what this practice is about. It's not about hugging it, taking it on as part of your own karmic backpack. It's about dissolving it in your own awakened heart. In other words, this practice is about transmutation. It's about transformation. It's not about taking on somebody else's karma in a way that's going to cause you more trouble. Does that make sense? So that's something to really contemplate, actually, that your consciousness, when you sincerely do this practice, is in and of itself transformative. Your heart is transformative. It's, you know, you are creating inside your heart a vortex of consciousness that can dissolve many particles of, and, you know, as stronger our consciousness gets, many, many aspects of another person's suffering, at least in the sense that they can momentarily experience a sense of ease or peace. And that in itself is a big blessing. Yes.
Yeah, and Catherine said yes and thank you.
Okay.
I have another question from one of our online people. Radha,
Radha.
It's R-A-D. And Radha, okay. The breathing in of the dark smoke was tough to do, almost too much to find the light from the cave of the heart. How do I deepen the light of the cave of the heart during the Tonglen practice if it feels really dark?
Well, I would, you know, if it feels like you're not in touch with the light in the heart, let go of the Tonglen and really go back to cultivating the love field in the heart, you know, the light in the heart, using the mantra. And then when it feels like you've strengthened it a bit, then go back to breathing in the pain of the other. It doesn't have to be in the form of smoke. It could just be, you know, it could be in a less visual form if that works better for you. But this is a practice. So you actually learn how to calibrate it, and you learn how to make the heart cave stronger when need be, when it feels overwhelming. And as you do it, you discover the rhythm of it, and you discover the way in which the more you strengthen the heart, the more you can start to feel that the suffering, the imagined suffering that you're taking on, is actually able to metabolize itself, to transform itself. So play with it in that way. Just when the heart feels shaky, come back to strengthening it, and then go back to the Tonglen practice. And again, thank you for asking. That's a really good question.
Do you have time for one more question?
Yeah, we have time for one more.
Okay. Dory says, your comment in an earlier class that we've all had an excellent birth left me confused. I'm grateful and accepting of my life, and I've made much progress in consciousness growth, but I have a hard time reconciling how my terrifying childhood constitutes a good birth. Can you speak to this?
Yes. What constitutes a good birth is a birth in which we can do spiritual practice. So often having had really, really difficult childhood experiences is part of what creates the field for our dedication to practice. And it's a hard way to come into life. But it doesn't deny the power of the birth that you've had and the work that you've been able to do. For whatever karmic reason, and, you know, we don't necessarily know what that was about, it may not even have been about you. It may have been about some work that your family members needed to move through. But it created the person that you are, and the person that you are is a profoundly, in many, many ways, awake, and even more than that, really dedicated to the expansion and the cultivation of your own consciousness. So, of course, it's a precious human birth. It's you know, many of our most precious births are birthed out of difficult circumstances. But what makes it precious is that you're able to work with those circumstances and, you know, turn it to the advantage of your soul. And what could be better than that? So again, thank you for that question.
And we've got we've got another question.
Okay.
From someone in maybe Florida. If you've raised
okay.
your hand.
Yes. Hi.
Hi, this is Marilyn.
Hi, Marilyn. Can you speak into the phone or whatever device you're using?
One or two devices. Is this better now?
This is better. But it's still a little hard to hear you.
I'll make it better in a second.
Okay. Speak loud.
How's this?
Good.
Is that better? Yeah.
Yes.
Okay. Yeah, thank you, Sally, for everything, for your wonderful compassion and your teaching of compassion. One second, let me just change. I felt this practice really challenged the suppleness of my heart, something I'd really love to develop. If I'm feeling very light in my heart, it's like really difficult to bring in smoke and the darkness. I guess it feels a little threatening that so often that darkness felt like, you know, it was something that would fragment me and take me apart or something. And likewise, when I'm feeling really bad, it's hard to introduce the light, just like those changes, introducing one to the other and back. Just doesn't feel like I quite have that suppleness. Wonder how best to develop that.
Well, I would do it I would titrate. So in other words, do this practice for just a couple of minutes and then introduce the mantra or a breath full of light into the region of the heart and move back and forth. It's you know, I know exactly what you mean, that it takes a while for the heart to cook and become supple enough, and that's a really good word, to self-transform, you know, to toggle back and forth between difficult feelings and light feelings. Mm-hmm. The thing is that they're both there, and the light feelings, though it may not always seem like that, are actually more powerful. And so don't, you know, if you're having a hard time with it, don't try to do it for too long. Just do it for a couple of minutes and come back to a practice that is known to have a positive effect on your heart. Stay with it for a while and then go back to the Tonglen. And I honestly can promise you that your consciousness knows how to do this.
Mm-hmm.
So as you become willing to play with it, you get it. It's like, mm-hmm. you know, it's like any subtle practice. It just takes some practice.
Yeah, I think I'm needing that. It sounds exciting to try. Thank you.
Yes, it is. It is. It is. So thank you all for your questions, and thank you for your practice. And we're going to just come back into the heart. The official class is coming to an end. Dev is going to play the goddess mantras for us, and you can sit for a while with the sound and practicing in the heart cave, perhaps with the mantra, or just sitting, being present, or journaling if that feels appropriate. And we'll be sending the homework tomorrow. Please listen to this class another couple of times, or at least another time, and you know, let yourself take in the nuance of it, especially of this Tonglen practice. So much, much love to all of you, and good night.
Mamba. No.
love.